I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. False invoices, shell companies, offshore accounts, faked mortgage documents, embezzlement. These are some of the allegations from testimony in the trial of Paul Manafort. The former Trump campaign chairman is accused of bank fraud and tax evasion, and this is special counsel Robert Mueller's first trial in his election interference investigation. The prosecution is expected to conclude their work today, and then it's the defense's turn. Manafort's lavish lifestyle has gotten a lot of attention, and so has the behavior of the judge, T.S. Ellis III. Rosalind Helderman is a reporter for The Washington Post. She's been covering this trial, and she joins us to get us all up to speed. Rosalind Helderman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I was going to begin with some of the charges against Manafort, but I think we need to talk about the judge first. This is called the Rocket Docket. How has he run this courtroom?
Well, he is a definite presence in this courtroom. As you said, the Eastern District of Virginia, where this trial is taking place, is known for its speed. And he has made it very, very clear repeatedly throughout each day that he wants to pick up the pace. So he has frequently interjected to interrupt the prosecutors, to ask sort of, what's the point of this question? What's the point of this evidence? Let's move this along. Let's narrow the scope. And, you know, it has had the effect of shortening the case. Some lawyers think that that actually helps the prosecution because a lot of this testimony is fairly dry, so it does not allow the prosecutors to kind of let their case drag. But there have been a lot of times when he has really scolded them in ways that could influence how the jury views the prosecution and its case.
Has he been tougher on the prosecution than the defense, or maybe when the defense gets to mount their part of the trial, he'll be tough on them too?
He has so far been tougher on the prosecution than the defense. But as you said, we've not seen all that much from the defense yet. And of course, you know, it is fair to point out that he is ensuring that Paul Manafort gets a fair trial. And that is part of his job in that courtroom. But there have been a number of times so far when he has chastised the prosecution in ways that that some lawyers have said fell over the top. He, in fact, actually apologized, half apologized
exactly.
Yesterday to the jury after the prosecution filed a motion essentially telling him that he had been wrong to scold them for allowing an expert witness to stay in the courtroom. He had been quite vigorous in saying that they shouldn't have done that, and it sort of suggested in front of the jury that they had kind of broken his rules. But if you look back in the transcript, he had actually allowed that expert explicitly to remain in the courtroom, and so he actually opened court yesterday by conceding he had probably been wrong about that. The prosecution has just this morning filed a motion asking him to tell the jury he was wrong about something else as during yesterday's testimony, and we'll see whether or not he agrees to do this 2 days in a row.
So these are comments, obviously, that largely the jury gets to hear. Any way to know how, when he's berating prosecutors, any way to know how that is affecting the jury? Any facial expressions or body language?
It's very hard to tell. The jury, from what I have seen, seems quite well dressed. They seem very engaged. They are taking copious notes, even during times when the testimony does get dry. It's extremely hard to know how they're being affected by anything. They have pretty good poker faces, and we'll just have to see as the trial goes on.
So let's go back to Paul Manafort. Specifically, what is he charged with then?
Sure. Well, it's important to remember that he actually faces two trials, and this is the first of the two. In this case, it's largely about his personal finances. So he is essentially charged with lying on his taxes in two different ways, which results in a bunch of different charges over different years. First, by underreporting his income. Basically, the prosecution says that he set up all these shell companies in Cyprus and in the Caribbean where Ukrainian oligarchs would pay him directly into these accounts, and then he would pay out of those accounts to support his lavish lifestyle, but not report the income and not pay taxes on it. You're also required under tax law to specifically report when you have offshore accounts. Year after year, he would not file the appropriate forms to tell the government he had those accounts. That's one set of the charges. The other set is that when his Ukrainian oligarch paymasters fell out of power in 2014, it appears as though his money kind of dried up, and he had been living this very lavish lifestyle. He had a lot of bills, and so he started filing loan applications against properties he owned, essentially trying to take out cash against those properties. And the prosecution charges that he engaged in bank fraud by submitting false and fraudulent information to those banks to get loans.
And are those all those documents, those are all available for the jury to see, so to speak?
Yes, and that's been a lot of the testimony, is sort of walking through those documents, walking through how they were put together and in what ways they represented inaccurate information.
Now, he worked for this former president of the Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych. I think between 2010 and 2014, he made something like $60 million. Is that correct?
Yes, the prosecution has said it's about $65 million that he made from Ukrainian oligarchs in support of his work for Mr. Yanukovych and his party in Ukraine.
And so after Yanukovych essentially fled Ukraine and was no longer Manafort's client, he ended up with no money. I guess we're trying to get to the bottom of how do you spend $60 million?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So he starts, you know, he buys all these properties and he kind of gets into a lifestyle that's very, very expensive. And then there are this these public protests in Ukraine in 2014. People may remember that there were crowds that were fired on by government troops and people died. And ultimately, Yanukovych fled Ukraine and is now residing in Russia. And after that, Paul Manafort's income starts to dry up from Ukraine. And so, in fact, in the year that he went to work for Donald Trump for free, people will remember, records show that his company had no clients and it had lost $600,000 for the year. That's one of the documents he is accused of submitting fraudulently to a bank. Basically, he took that income statement that showed his company had lost $600,000 a year. He converted it from a PDF into a Word document. He changed that figure to say he had made $3.1 million a year, and then he submitted it to a bank that had indicated he needed more income to support the loan he was seeking.
Breathtaking. The star witness, there have been some other witnesses as well, but obviously the star witness, Rick Gates, he was, I guess, a protege. He worked for Paul Manafort. He had some damning testimony, but he also had some of his own baggage in that I saw a headline saying basically he's a liar and a thief. And do you believe someone like that? How did he do on the stand? And what was his most damning thing with Paul Manafort?
Well, basically, he was there for all of this, and he was able to walk through sort of point by point how all of these schemes worked. The Manafort defense has very clearly been and will be more as we hear more from them, that he was kind of the big picture guy and that he delegated the managing of his personal finances largely to this kind of mentee protege, Rick Gates, and that it was Gates who was doing a lot of these things. It's a bit of a tough argument because there's been copious evidence that Manafort was kind of copied on all the documents, often issuing directions. So to say it was all Gates is a little hard, but they do have this kind of good argument that Gates himself is an admitted liar, thief, philanderer. They got Gates to admit on the stand that not only did he help Paul Manafort with all these schemes, but he used some of the same tactics to actually steal from Manafort, his boss, steal hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe millions of dollars from Manafort, kind of wiring money directly from Paul Manafort's accounts into his own.
It's just breathtaking to see when you add all this up, and it is this window into this world. I don't know whether this is the world of global consultants or, you know, informal lobbyists. Are you as kind of shocked as I think a lot of other people are?
Well, it's a real window into the Washington swamp, right? Mm. Early in the trial, one of the witnesses we heard from was Tad Devine. Tad Devine is a political consultant who essentially was the architect of the Bernie Sanders campaign. And basically, he had worked with Paul Manafort in Ukraine. They had worked together. So here you've got this political consultant who went from making millions of dollars in concert with a Republican operative to help a Russia-friendly politician in another country, and straight off that went to kind of running the Bernie Sanders, take on the establishment, fight for the 99% campaign. And that is the way that Washington works.
There's also a crazy story, and this involves a Chicago bank. I believe the head of the bank, a guy named Stephen Kalk. Tell us about this.
Sure. And I think from what we've heard that this is likely to be the subject of a lot of the testimony that will happen in today's hearings. So as Paul Manafort was seeking these bank loans, one of the loans he sought was from the Chicago bank. And we haven't quite heard a great deal about this yet, but I think we might be hearing today from witnesses at the bank who basically understood that he did not have the income to support the loans he was seeking. Mr. Kalk, the head of the bank, was interested in getting a job with the Trump administration, has been the allegation from prosecutors. And we have seen a few emails already where Manafort arranges for this man to get on an advisory committee for the campaign. And then after the election, Manafort is no longer associated with Trump, but his pal Rick Gates is working with the transition, and Manafort starts emailing Gates about how they need to get Stephen Kalk on the list to be considered for Secretary of the Army. Wow. And from what we've seen in court documents, it sounds like what the prosecution is going to argue is that basically Kalk agreed to kind of look the other way on this loan that Manafort really didn't qualify for in exchange for Manafort pushing him to become Secretary of the Army, of all things.
And we're talking about a loan of $16 million. Is that correct?
I think that's correct, yeah.
And did he get the loan or was he turned down? This he meaning, of course, Manafort.
I believe he did get the loan is my memory.
It's a many-tentacled case here. Here's a question from one of our listeners. Do we expect Roger Stone's name to show up in this trial? What do you think, Rosalyn?
I would not expect Roger Stone's name to come up. Stone is a longtime friend of Paul Manafort. However, he is not involved with the financial issues that are the heart of this case, and the judge has been very assiduous at keeping anything extraneous out at all. Roger Stone, of course, is a subject of a lot of other interests in Washington, just over the river, where the special counsel continues to bring witnesses in front of a grand jury. Mm-hmm. And most of the witnesses that we know about who have been before the grand jury in recent weeks are in some way connected to Roger Stone. So that's an interesting piece of the special counsel's case and an investigation, but I wouldn't expect it to come up in the Paul Manafort trial.
But in this Paul Manafort trial, does this have anything to do with election interference, which is essentially what Robert Mueller is investigating?
Not in any direct way. In fact, there was sort of an agreement at the start of the trial that neither side would essentially bring either Trump or Russia into this case. There have been a couple little mentions here and there of Trump, but for the most part, they've left it aside, even in instances when it would really be very relevant. It's interesting the way they talk about what happened in Ukraine in 2014. They kind of just say, Yanukovych's term ended without saying anything about Russia. But no, this case is really about Paul Manafort and his personal finances.
What's been his demeanor in the court?
He has come across as calm, confident. Obviously, he's highly aware that there's a jury in the courtroom a lot of the time, I would assume, and he wants to not look nervous. We know that he is spending his nights in jail, but by the time he gets to court inside the courtroom each morning, he is wearing a suit, one of his nice suits, I assume.
Not the ostrich one, right?
Not the ostrich one, but he's engaged. He wears glasses. He looks at all the documents. Occasionally, he whispers to his lawyers. He's certainly a presence at the defense table.
Is there family there? Does he have supporters there from what you can see?
It appears that his wife has been there each day, and she's generally, from what I've seen, been accompanied by someone else who must be a family member or a friend. It's a little hard to tell. The courtroom is very, very crowded. A lot of reporters. It's a little hard to know who is who, but he is accompanied each day by his wife.
I mentioned the fact that prosecutors are going to try to close things up today. And then what, next week the defense mounts their defense?
That's correct. And we have not yet heard from them as to the big question of this and really every trial, which is, does Paul Manafort himself intend to take the stand?
Right.
I think legal experts would find that very surprising, particularly given that he still faces this other trial in Washington in September. But you never do know. So we'll have to hear from them how many witnesses they intend to put on, what kind of witnesses. And then it would seem likely that the case would go to the jury probably sometime next week.
Oh, wow. So that really is a rocket docket there. So we don't know at this point who the defense is going to put on the stand.
That's exactly right. And of course, they're not required to put anyone on the stand. Right. They could argue just that they have kind of punched enough holes in the prosecution's case through their cross-examination of the prosecution witnesses. So we'll have to hear from them who, if anyone, they intend to put on the stand.
Well, Rosalind Helderman, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times, getting us up to speed on this important and complicated case.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She's a reporter for The Washington Post, does political investigations and enterprise reporting. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program, download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, also sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.